we're on the record on the 28th of September with Nestor Dominguez and Assorted Council. I'm Kim Schaefer. It's roughly 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
I am Linda Imes from Spears and Imes LLP. Go ahead, Nestor.
Nestor Dominguez.
I'm Thomas Lee from Spears and Imes LLP.
Michael Berger from Paul Weiss.
Thank you. Mr. Dominguez, you've testified before and you've been interviewed before by the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, so I will dispense with the background about the commission and dispense with asking you about your professional background. Remind you, however, that you're supposed to tell the truth. I have no reason to believe that you would not. The past reasons why you were asked to talk to us related more to investigation of Citigroup and why it was in the situation that it ended up being in. The discussion today, I hope, although it certainly will build on your experience at Citigroup, is more about market developments. And given that Citi was one of the leaders in the CDO market, we thought it was appropriate to ask for more of your time and insights. And I do occasionally double check that this is actually running.
Kim, may I just say to Nestor that since she's recording this, you need to wait till she's finished with her question and then respond.
Okay.
Otherwise, when people are listening to it later on, they won't be able to hear all of your pearls of wisdom. So.
Okay.
Okay.
I would, however, like you to consent for the record to the taping of the interview, just so we have that. I need you to say yes rather than nod your head, since there's no camera. Thank you. Okay. I'd like to start really jumping right in with why you think the CDO business grew to be as large as it did. And sorry, I would it would be helpful to have on this tape just what were your titles, if there were any changes between 04 and 07 or 08 at Citi? Just so we have that.
I believe in my recollection is in 2006 I became co-head of the business. Prior to that, I was...
You were managing director,
yes.
But you were part of the business.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And was it called the CDO Group?
It was in structured credit. The department, the larger department, was called Structured Credit Products. And the CDO Group, I'm not quite sure what the official, you know, name was of it, was within that group. It was the largest part of that, the Structured Credit Department.
And when did you leave?
My last official day at Citi was January of 2008.
Okay. All right. Sorry. So you were at Citi for quite a number of years and saw the development of the whole CDO market in various asset classes, but why did it become such a big business?
Well, I got involved in the CDO business while at Salomon Brothers, precursor to Citigroup. At that time, I'd have to say that the biggest reason why people, why institutions got involved was that they wanted leveraged products in asset classes that they didn't necessarily have direct expertise in. So in other words, an insurance company wanted exposure to high yield bonds, but didn't have an entire high-yield research department to do analysis on individual bonds. And in addition to that, there was an element of the leverage that was embedded in the in the structure itself that enhanced the yield. So I think the I think in a nutshell, it was investors getting exposure in their portfolios to asset classes in that where they couldn't necessarily devote all the resources or technology to become expert in. So they effectively rented or bought that expertise through the CDO structure. I would say that was the overwhelming reason. But like I said, in addition, there was leverage built into the structure that then created a higher yielding product.
Leverage for all subordinate investors.
Exactly.
So then, just to be a touch more analytic, why were AAA investors interested?
Well, it's pretty much the same reason, because who were the big AAA investors? They were conduits. They were bank portfolios. They were structured investment vehicles. So in other words, they were all the vehicles that could fund at very tight levels. And so it was really a matter of relative valuation, where whereas they could go out into the market and buy individual AAA securities, but they traded at much tighter levels, like RMBS and student loans and European AAA commercial real estate and things like that. Or, again, depending on market conditions, they could buy the AAA tranche of a CDO, high yield CDO or CLO, and because the CDO product tended to be newer in the marketplace, had fewer investors following it, it tended to trade at a spread to those more generic single name products. And so
not everyone knows the jargon. At a spread, you mean that the coupon, the interest rate, was higher?
Was higher, yes.
CDS. Please continue.
Sorry about that. So, to give you an example, a European RMBS transaction might trade at LIBOR plus 20 basis points. A diversified CLO, I think in the tightest got around LIBOR plus 20, but more often LIBOR plus 40. So there was an extra 40 basis points. And so, but that required, so the market for those AAA tranches were not levered investors per se, but tended to be investors that funded very well.
So if you look at data on, particularly on the ABS CDO market, I believe I have. I hope I have this right. If your recollection is different, please correct me. The volume, issuance volume, and I'm speaking of the overall market, not just at Citi, although Citi may well have tracked this as well. Mm-hmm. Doubled from 04 to 05. Doubled again from 05 to 06. And I think also doubled from 03 to 04. So. That's an extraordinary growth curve. How come?
Well, the entire CDO market doubled and doubled again and doubled again, not just ABS. I mean, I remember specifically in 2003 we did three CLOs or four CLOs, and we did 30 in 2006. So it was a growth of the whole market. First of all, you had economic growth, global economic growth during that period of time. You had a period of declining rates globally and tightening credit spreads. And so both as a result of growth and declining credit spreads, you had a lot of capital from overseas, and a lot of investors were overseas investors, which continues to date, you know, emerging markets and all that stuff. That was a big part of the market. And you had declining rates and spreads. And so at the same time, you had a lot of capital come into the fixed income markets. You had tightening spreads, and so people were looking for other forms of leverage. Because a LIBOR plus 20 AAA floater has a very limited clientele, but if you can lever that up 3, 4, 5 times, then that appeals to a wider variety of investors. And you can either take leverage individually as an institution, or you can take leverage within the structure. And clearly the market, there was all sorts of, there were different kinds of investors that did different methodologies for, you know, leveraging up a low yielding asset to get something that's more acceptable to their end investors.
So, sticking with the leverage theme, mm-hmm. and sticking with my being a little nitpicky, mm-hmm. about saying that the AAA investor within the CDO structure, mm-hmm. was not levered, because they're, mm-hmm. They're at the top. And if you interpret this differently, you know, I'm interviewing you. I'm mm-hmm. just trying to mm-hmm. lay this out. And given that AAAs are 70%, 80% of the capital structure, is it that those AAA buyers external to the CDO had means to lever their investment?
External to the CDO.
Yes. That was an important factor in their AAA interest. And I suppose I'm hinting at SIVs.
Well, exactly, exactly.
And
so
conduits.
Right, so those two, SIVs and conduits, have 1% equity tranche. Right, so they're 100 times levered to the equity to begin with, and so they could lever. They're by definition, they were levered investors. Banks, but you know, banks even now, after a lot more capital, are 12 times levered. So the AAA buyers, by and large, had other means to lever. So hedge funds, you did not find hedge funds buying AAA tranches, because they couldn't lever those. Even after leverage, they couldn't lever as many times.
There did develop a product called the Leverage Super Senior. Was that common with regard to ABS CDOs, or predominantly with corporate credit CDOs?
That was almost entirely corporate credit CDOs.
Why?
I've actually forgotten. I think the... we did one. I think it was the only one. And I forgot exactly what it was. It took about a year and of discussions with the rating agencies. I just think it's a question of the methodology had not been thought through by the rating agencies, you know, before the crisis.
While we're on the leverage theme, do you, in retrospect, think, why was everyone able to lever so much Do you have any...
Why were those institutions able to lever so much?
Or the sieves, or... There seem to be little check on the ability or little pushback on that ability to lever.
Well, so who's pushing back? So normally it would be investors. Investors, if a sieve issued debt and equity, the investors would normally say, if it was too levered or inappropriate somehow, the investors would say, we either charge more for their debt and equity or say no, just like what's happening right now. So what led to their ability to be levered? Is that the question? And it is a combination of these capital structures and the market's perception are all derived from historical performance, right? So one of the reasons why foreign investors wanted to get involved in CDOs and sieves and conduits is because historically, and this goes back a couple of decades, they had performed so well. They performed so well with respect to low default rates and consistently low default rates over a couple of years. And so the market had developed perceptions and beliefs as to the probabilities of default of the underlying securities, and that's what led to the creation of conduits, the ability of conduits to lever and the ability of sieves to lever. You know, and then, you know, the rating agencies use these historical relationships to establish criteria, and the market accepted those criteria and priced its securities accordingly. So it was a closed system, because it doesn't work without both sides, the market, the regulators, and the rating agencies all accepting the same premise. Because clearly sieves would not have worked had the market disagreed with, you know, the capital structure proposed, which is, of course, you know, what happens all the time when something comes to market and it doesn't make sense. But it made sense. It made sense given the historical experience. And so the market accepted them, actually priced them incredibly tight. Priced, as you know, commercial paper conduits and sieves were issued commercial paper to fund themselves. And that commercial paper traded better than most banks. You know, not better than Citi or anything of that nature, but traded through LIBOR. It was LIBOR minus 10 to 20. So that's better. That's that's on par with the best corporate names in the United States. So the market was pricing these securities, you know, on the same level with, you know, Johnson & Johnson, Monsanto, and better than IBM, and, you know, a lot of very high quality corporates. So that was all part of why the institutions were allowed to leverage, as the market allowed them.
So, if you know some rough numbers or have a view in CDOs, what, you know, roughly, what proportion of the AAAs ended up in conduits, in sieves, in monolines, on underwriters' balance sheets, on other banks' balance sheets?
So are you talking about on a national level?
On an aggregate view of the market, if it's easier for you to answer in terms of your experience at Citi, please. And this is just your you know, rough view of the market.
Almost all of it. Almost all of it on a percentage base and quantity. Ended up in conduits, commercial paper conduits, sieves, and bank balance sheets. Because there were no other, there wasn't any other investor class who could fund as well and as at lowest spread as those. So they were the dominant buyers.
You said commercial paper,
conduits,
bank balance sheets.
Bank balance sheets and SIFs. And by bank balance sheets, I don't mean dealer balance sheets. There was a large amount of AAAs purchased by banks for investment purposes.
Thank you. Then there's another strand of the story with negative basis trades.
Yes.
And the banks, I guess the banks, really. Maybe it was the conduits as well. Saying, okay, we'll provide the funding.
Yes.
But we don't want the credit risk.
That's right.
So
yes.
We need to find AIG or the monoline.
Yes.
Or someone else.
Yes.
To take the credit risk.
That's
so
right.
How important were those players to the growth of this market?
The negative basis trade, so just to have everybody on the same page, where an institution that funded well would purchase the cash security and then simultaneously purchase protection on that identical security from a monoline or typically a monoline or someone else. And so the cash security would pay LIBOR plus 50 and protection would cost 10 basis points, and so you would net 40 basis points, which was far greater than the funding costs of the security, which was typically LIBOR minus. And so Royal Bank of Scotland, for example, was a big negative basis portfolio. How important was that? That was important. That was a significant part of the market. I don't have any numbers on what percentage because every transaction was private. But it's significant. It was a significant part. The part that made it most meaningful was that every transaction was huge. And so where a normal syndication process, you would be selling 10s and 20s and 30s and 50 million blocks to various institutions. Nobody would care about a negative basis trade unless you were doing at least 500 million. And so there might have not have been a lot of players globally because they were all the largest kind of funding banks, but every single trade was in the 500 to, you know, billion-dollar range. And that's what made it, you know, very valuable and very convenient, certainly.
One-stop shopping.
One transaction. There's a lot of documentation involved and ISDAs and but once you had your ISDA in place and you got get the system down and negotiated broad terms with an RBS or a SocGen, then you could do multiple transactions in large size, and so that was very convenient from that perspective.
From what I reviewed, so again, correct me if I have a misunderstanding, Citi actually did little with AIG.
That's right.
At least compared to other CDO underwriters.
We didn't do anything with AIG.
How come?
We could never come to terms. I don't know. It's the, you know, I don't, honestly don't know. You know, we are, city was, we had a very client-focused business. So investors, we try to encourage investors to come to us and we will create deals for that investor. And